to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Nick Lawson speaks on managing an emergency, behind the scenes at Doctors Without Borders. Born in Sydney, Australia, and raised in Perth, Nick Lawson is the Director of Field Human Resources at Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. He began working for MSF as a logistical and administrative expert in southern Sudan during the country's brutal civil war in 1997. Since then, he has held 11 other positions within the organization, which have taken him to Afghanistan, Burundi, East Timor, and Malawi. Mr. Lawson's extensive field experience eventually led him to the headquarter role of recruitment officer for the Field Human Resources at MSF Australia in Sydney. Today, he continues to use these skills to lead in the New York-based human resources team that recruits and places Americans in MSF projects. On Friday, March 13th, he spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on managing an emergency, behind the scenes at Doctors Without Borders. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents the Director of Field Human Resources at Doctors Without Borders, Nick Lawson.
Thank you, everybody. It's a great pleasure for me to be in Alaska. My current guise within MSF is as the Field Human Resources Director. It's a position whereby I manage a team and we search for US nationals who I send to what I'd like to regard as probably fairly difficult places. Alaska for me has always been kind of important since I've arrived in the job. I was for a couple of years the recruiting officer in Australia and I recognised very quickly that some of the people with the most immediately relevant experience that we can use came from our own outback societies who had exposure to difficult conditions and indigenous populations. And so when I arrived in the US, I sort of thought, right, there's somewhere here that really does replicate that background. And so we have started coming to Alaska. We were here last year for the first time. We're here this time. I'm here this time. We will be coming back again specifically to look for physicians, paramedicals, nurses, pharmacists, lab techs, and non-medical staff, logisticians, in order, because we believe that, that people who live in extreme circumstances such as this have something to offer the populations that we try to assist and have an understanding of some of the difficulties of some of the remote locations that we are. So without sort of pleasure about being in Alaska, I'll just a quick introduction of myself. As Brian pointed out, I am an Australian. I started as a logistician 12 years ago in Sudan. I have since that time been through various positions within the organisation, from logistics through project coordination, as a technical coordinator in East Timor, an emergency coordinator for Pakistan, Kenya, and finally as a head of mission in Burundi and Malawi. I'll just move. I have several slides for you this afternoon to have a look through. I'm sorry, you're going to have to probably swivel or listen or turn or whatever. I'm not sure, but what I'd like to do is give you a background about myself and about the organisation. That's me in Pakistan. Actually, the earthquake occurred in 2005, and in the background, what you can see is a population who had their houses completely destroyed. That photo was taken the day that we arrived. Myself, a medical coordinator and a logistical coordinator, arrived in Islamabad. We did not have a base in Pakistan at the particular time, and we had the three of us, but very quickly following us, there were two full 747s with equipment that we needed and the staff that we were going to use to establish a hospital system that I will show you a little bit later. There I'm talking to a Pakistani military medical doctor and a Croatian, I think it's a Croatian emergency coordinator. And that's the very, sort of probably about day three of the emergency situation in Pakistan. I think everybody sort of knows who MSF actually is. What I'd like to do is probably give a little bit of a background into how we got started. We originally really came from the Biafran crisis in Nigeria in 71. Basically what happened was the Nigerian government was blockading the Biafran region, the Biafran secessionists, in order to prevent the Biafrans from gaining access to supplies and military and food. And basically it was the Nigerian government had laid siege to Biafra. There was a team of doctors who were working for the International Committee of the Red Cross at that point. The International Committee of the Red Cross is a very important organisation. It's a very powerful organisation, but it does have a particularly strict neutrality approach or neutral approach. By that I mean they don't actually speak out when circumstances perhaps require speaking out. So the physicians who were working for the Red Cross saw that there was this terrible situation that was unfolding for the Biafran civilian population, who were having no access to food, who were having no access to any of the medical facilities that they needed, and they felt that the only way to resolve that issue was to raise the world's awareness of it. So what they did was they came back to France and basically split off from the ICRC, from the International Committee of the Red Cross, and with a group of reporters started Médecins Sans Frontières. We are strictly a humanitarian medical emergency organisation. It is what is our core background. It's what we do. We are probably the world's largest private organisation in that particular regard, and we are our activity really is born around the Medical Act in difficult circumstances, and also what we would probably loosely define in the English language as bearing witness, reporting on circumstances that we see, advocating on behalf of populations who are suffering and who do not have a voice. We don't advocate for the sake of advocating. We advocate for the sake of a change in a particular circumstance. There are many different examples of that. The first and most classic is the Biafran situation, but it's really run through a whole variety of different advocacy roles. One most recently, over the last probably 5 or 6 years, which has been a great success for us, has been about access to essential medicines or access to antiretroviral treatment for African patients suffering with HIV in their various countries, and the problems around patent laws and pharmaceutical companies and so on and so forth. And our advocacy role in that has been very strong. So really, if the core of what we are is a medical act to vulnerable populations and an advocacy role for people who don't have access to a voice for their own. Probably the most important thing, and the thing that underpins us completely, is our charter. This is a slightly truncated version of it. It's called From the MSF Charter. It's not actually the charter. But really, it's the key of what we do. What we do is we provide assistance to populations in distress, to victims of natural or man-made disasters, and to victims of armed conflict. And we do that regardless of race, religion, creed, or political conviction. We are there to provide a medical service for humans. That's what we do. That's it. You know, we're not there for any other particular reason. We have no other agenda, and we're not linked to any other organisation or belief. We're not faith-based. We are specifically medically based. We observe neutrality and impartiality. That means we will treat anybody who is unwell. We are pretty strict about the nature of no weapons and not having arms within our structures, our vehicles, our work and life. But we will certainly provide medical facilities for soldiers who arrive in our clinics. Primarily, we are there to provide an assistance to the population. We undertake to respect a professional code of ethics, and we maintain a complete independence from all political, economic and religious powers. It's really critical in these days as governments move around the world and choose to use humanitarian aid occasionally in furthering their own political agendas, that there is that there exists independent humanitarian space. Really, for the populations who suffer, we feel there is a right that they have to access medical care without that being contingent upon a political situation, a political agenda, an economic agenda, a religious agenda. We really feel that humans have a right to that medical care, and we sort of demand an independence in the action of what we do. We are strongly empowered in that through independent financial support. And that really comes from people such as yourselves. We do not take, in some circumstances, we do accept institutional funds. I know the United States section of MSF does not take any institutional funding. We are 100% privately funded, and it allows us then to utilise the money in the way that we see fit, that we have learnt how to use over the last nearly 40 years of activity. So really, the critical aspects, we provide assistance to populations in distress, we are neutral, we are impartial, and we are independent. I'll continue on. So we provide medical programs in more than 60 countries around the world. How should I put it? It fluctuates every year. Some things will close, some things will open. There is ongoing conflict in a variety of areas, and I'll come to that more as a focus this afternoon. Really, it's a bit misleading, I guess, that photo. I mean, we certainly don't have many programs in the middle of Siberia. But certainly the areas around of Central Asia and most predominantly Sub-Saharan Africa is really where we've got a very strong presence internationally. We've got more than 24,000 field positions. 8% of that's made up of international staff. And so we're roughly sort of 2,000 full-time positions for international staff, and then to roughly 22,000 for national staff. And so that's our Angolan staff, our Chechen staff, our Sudanese staff. They really are the backbone of what we do. A lot of them have been working for MSF for a very long time. They know the programs inside out. They know the programs better than the expatriates do. And they really provide the core. And they also put themselves... They are motivated to put themselves in difficult situations similarly to us to provide assistance to their own population. I think Somalia is a very good example at the moment. The Somali staff, we have had to withdraw from Somalia. It's not tenable that we are there because it is just too violent. We cannot provide the services, or we cannot put expats on the ground. They are being targeted. We are very worried. The debate then rages: if it's not acceptable for us to put expatriates, how can we ethically continue to encourage or to maintain national staff in these positions? Aren't they similarly at risk? It is the national staff themselves that demand that we continue. They are the ones who are pushing for us to be there. They are the ones who recognise that they can do something very powerful for their own population, and so we can continue to support with a very good supply of medical equipment to those national staff, and they will keep the surgical programs, the therapeutic feeding programs going. They do a marvellous job. Somalia is just one example. It's a really clear example at the moment because it is a mess. It's the worst country. It's hard to say anything's a worst country, but it is a very, very difficult situation at the moment in Somalia. We run to approximately $800 million on an annual budget. As I said, 95% of that will come from private funding. When political situations mean that we're unable, that some organisations must withdraw because the government who is funding them says, well, we're not going to fund access to that country, then we're able to continue. And I've seen that in personal situations in Afghanistan. In 1999, the various governments around the world, the UK government especially, withdrew its funding and a lot of agencies were forced to close. We were able to continue, and in the end, in the northern part of Afghanistan, it was ourselves and the Red Cross who were the only ones who were left standing, and that was possible simply through the private donations of people such as yourselves. And we had more than 8.7 million consultations in 2007. So where do we get involved? We are really... conflict is the majority of where we work. The historical hotspots have been places like Sudan, Afghanistan, the Congo, Somalia is on. Western Africa has been in great difficulty through Sierra Leone and Liberia. We really have been critical in these areas for many years. In some circumstances, especially Liberia, we were the Ministry of Health. The Ministry of Health, one of the you know, we ran two hospitals there, and we provided the health care for the Liberian countryside for a very long period of time. It is difficult to work in these locations. We are constantly negotiating, constantly explaining our presence there. But really, conflict is the worst of all situations. When I see difficult occurrences that have been caused by poverty or been caused by government neglect, they're bad, but conflict is really the destroyer. It's an amazing, very, very quickly, you have very difficult situations. It's of course, you straight out wounds, deaths, the morbidity and mortality in conflict is enormous. And it's not just, you know, the two sides shooting at each other. It's also then what's more critical for us is the complete destruction or the complete disappearance of a public or state structure to provide medical care for a civilian population. So even though you have various armed groups that are trying to purport that they are the ones that should be looking after the population, the first thought of them is generally for their own soldiers, and the civilian population suffers enormously. There's been some pretty horrific studies that have been done, certainly in the Eastern Congo, where the conflict has been going on for many, many years now, and it's caused the death of millions and millions of people, not only through direct violence, but also through a complete lack of medical care. And that's really what we do. That's when it hits an emergency state, and that's when we're in a position to be able to respond. Epidemics. Currently, this particular year, unfortunately, we've seen already Nigeria, Niger, and Chad have had outbreaks of meningitis. It's a very dangerous disease. It spreads very, very quickly, and it is a killer. We are in a position where we're very experienced in this, and we can vaccinate millions of people over a period of weeks quite quickly. We have extremely good logistical support, and we can be very reactive very quickly. So we're involved in that quite a lot. Malnutrition. We have been dealing in Ethiopia, in southern Sudan, terrible nutritional crises where we've been pioneering recently new modes of treatment whereby we do not need to have children. And really, malnutrition affects the children under five. That's basically the group that we're sort of targeting and trying to ensure survives. And the work and our experience there has shifted our therapeutic approach from round-the-clock feeding, which is enormously labour-intensive, down to now what we call ambulatory care. And basically that means that we've with producers of a particular therapeutic food, which is basically peanut paste jam-packed with micronutrients, is really a very powerful tool in treating. And we can give a box of this to the family and we can come back in a week and the child has put on and gained weight much more quickly and much more effectively than the original milk products that we used to try and give them. So we've been very successful in terms of that. And so that's been Ethiopia, Sudan's had terrible famines, and Niger most recently. We have had difficulties in Niger. One of our sections was forced out of the country. It's a long sort of involved story, but we continue on with four other sections. In there. And natural disasters. My personal experience has been in Pakistan in the earthquake. Certainly the cyclone Nargis in Myanmar last year and the tsunami in Southeast Asia were very good examples of our response during natural disasters. Natural disasters are quite interesting, actually, because, in fact, what you have in a natural disaster is an enormous outpouring of human support. The population of the country itself is there very quickly. There is an enormous number of people who fly in from around the world to try and support. In actual fact, what they're missing is a place to work. It's all been destroyed. So there's really nowhere that people can actually function. And we learnt that, and in Pakistan we were very effective with an inflatable hospital system. But I will show that to you in a little bit. My experience in conflict. This is a picture from Sudan. As I said before, conflict really is a terrible. The reasons of conflict are infinite. Generally, it has to do with power and people who desire power. But really, the costs are immeasurable. Sometimes the damage that's inflicted upon a population, the destruction of the public system, the violence that goes down. And it's way, as I said before, much beyond just the violence between the soldiers themselves. We have direct war wounded. We have gunshots. We have shrapnel. There's mines. There's an enormous amount of sexual violence. It's something that we've been reporting on now for a few years. Really, quite horrific figures are coming out of the Congo about the use of sexual violence as a tool for the military. It's a dreadful situation. And then beyond that, we have the displacement of populations as well. So very quickly, my experience when I was in Burundi, when the Congolese fighting would break out, we would prepare ourselves and we knew that within days there would be thousands of Congolese crossing the border into Burundi, and we had to establish medical facilities for them. We had to establish work in partnership with the various international organisations to provide healthcare, food, water and shelter. The refugees are incredible, the general healthcare, and then when people move, you have congregations of people or people gathering together, thousands of people gathering together, you create very quickly situations that are rife for the possibilities of cholera. Measles is a very, very dangerous disease when you have stressed populations under five. It's, you know, when we were all kids, we caught measles and we got sick and we got better and it was fine. In Africa or wherever, when you have malnourished children, you have measles, the kid will die. So one of the first acts that we have to do in a refugee setting following conflict is to vaccinate every kid under five just with measles. There are a whole bunch of other vaccinations that we can sort of think about, but really the measles is a critical one at that point. Malnutrition and then continuing violence is always a problem that we face. That's the Burundian refugee camp that I spoke of just now. That's really where people go. They come out of the Congo. Prior to this camp being established, this was a green field with trees. And, you know, there are also these side costs to a refugee situation which make it very difficult as well. You have a sudden influx of population which needs desperately help, but at the same time they may have flooded to an area which is vulnerable in itself, and that mass influx of people disturbs the balance of life within those societies and causes conflict and problems as well. So there's sort of this unfortunately never-ending cycle of problem that we are trying to address. This is a shot from Afghanistan. I won't say I like the shot, but I think it was fairly indicative of the situation that we were faced with. Very young soldiers, armed to the teeth, in a country which is full of mines and which was damaging people, such as you see in the poor fellow in the background with the crutches. I worked in Afghanistan over a four-year period, from 1998, 1999, 2000 and 2001. In total, I was in the country for two whole years. I was a logistician, a project coordinator for that period of time. And it really was a period where this was all prior. My final visit to Afghanistan was in May 2001. This was prior to the events that occurred in New York and the subsequent conflict after that. I was there when it was a civil war. And our responsibility, we had been in Afghanistan for a very long time, ever since the Russian invasion in 1979. Well, not since the Russian invasion, but when the Russians were there, from about 1984, we were supporting the Afghan population. Back in those days, you would probably argue that we weren't particularly neutral. We really didn't have clinics set up for the Russians. We did have clinics on the Afghan side, but then as the Russians left and the Afghan population then imploded and there was a terrible civil war, we really then started to provide clinics right across the country. And in my period of time as the field coordinator, we were really responsible for running two districts, one which had a front line that ran through it, and very often I was running across, driving across front lines with drugs to supply both sides of the clinics. And in those days, our neutrality and our impartiality was respected. People knew who we were. People knew that we were independent and that we were just providing medical care, and both sides of the conflict allowed us free passage. That was a very clear example of proper humanitarian space. As things have unfolded, as the conflict in Afghanistan has now shifted from a civil war to, I guess I would probably very basically categorise it as perhaps an anti-Western jihad now, then we're confronted with a different dynamic and a different perception of us. We are seen then potentially as an arm or as in some way in support or in link to the various powers that are representing the West, and we are a Western representation. That is not our position. Our position is very clearly that we hope to support the Afghan civilian population, that we are not linked to any side. It has cost us terribly in Afghanistan. We withdrew in 2004 because a number of our people were killed, were assassinated in 2004. We haven't been back since then. At the moment, very carefully, we believe that the situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated to an extent where we are looking at returning. We currently have a head of mission and a medical coordinator who are in Peshawar, just very slowly remaking the contacts that we had before, learning the language. It's very critical that we're able to speak on an immediate basis with people. So they're learning Dari, they're learning Pashto, and they are looking to find areas to get back. The situation in Afghanistan hasn't reached bottom. It will reach bottom again, unfortunately. And it's a shame. I personally have a great deal of time for the country. I spent a long time there. And it's terribly sort of moving or emotive for me to think of again, they had this possibility post September in 2001. And it's fallen apart again. The projects that we were running in Afghanistan really were clinics. We would set up four clinics in a particular region. We would have basically primary healthcare, and this is, as you can see, a very rudimentary situation. But that's really what people need. You know, the conflict is not a daily thing for me. A war, before I entered into wars, I always thought it was kind of like a hot firefight all the time, but it's really not. Basically, it's a long, slow, drawn-out situation with the occasional hot firefight, but really a destruction of the systems within the society. And so here we are in a position to be able to set up just basic primary healthcare for a population that just doesn't have access to it. The projects, we would have roughly four clinics around a particular town on varying perimeters out, 1 hour drive, 2 hour drive, 3 hour drive, and we would refer then to a central hospital. We would have both expat and national staff supporting those clinics. The nature of humanitarian space, I show this one because it's the weapons that we want to make sure that that people are very clear about, that we are a medical organisation, that we're not involved there's no room in our structures for arms. It gets difficult. We believe that the debate surrounding military and humanitarian aid has become very, very blurred. And as I said before, there are many governments around the world who use humanitarian aid as part of their military objectives as well, as part of their foreign policy agenda. We are very clear to try to delineate ourselves from that, to reject that as a ploy. We are very strictly neutrally humanitarian. And unfortunately, the lines that get crossed sometimes are such that we have. It's happened very rarely, but we have lost lives in the organisation. Currently, today, we are facing an enormous humanitarian space crisis in Darfur. I'm sure a number of you are aware that MSF, two of the sections of the organisation, have been expelled from Darfur. We think there's an element to it being linked to the International Criminal Court's indiction of the leader of Sudan, and his response has been to expel 13 organisations. So we're confronted with that, and so that's an argument and a debate that we must have at this point in time to ensure that it's very clear that MSF does not engage with the ICC. It brings a terrible risk to our patients. It's not our role. We are a medical humanitarian organisation. We are not a human rights organisation. We are not a humanitarian affairs organisation. It's very critical for us that we understand that we are there arguing and debating and being part of that debate, but it's not our goal to push. Our goal is to make sure that medical humanitarian assistance is provided, and we need to work a very clear humanitarian space for that to occur. In Afghanistan, this is the sort of thing that we would do. That's a clinic that we ran. We will rehabilitate the clinics and try to make sure that the facilities are very good. I was explaining to a group last night, one of the things that I'm extraordinarily proud of in this organisation is the quality of material that we actually get into a lot of these places. And I'll talk a little bit about logistics as well in a second. But this is the sort of thing that we would run in Afghanistan. We'd have a clinic like this. It would provide primary healthcare and it would provide referral services for a huge number of people that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. We also look at rehabilitation. Really, as I said before, what we've got to have is space to work. There's got to be somewhere. This is Benson Hospital in Liberia. As you can see, it's. I mean, I I wish I was the logistician who did that. You know, that's an impressive looking building. And so when after many years of violence and shelling and there aren't a lot of, you know, decent standing buildings that are left. And Benson Hospital, as I said before, was one of the hospitals whereby MSF almost literally took over the Ministry of Health. I won't say took over the Ministry of Health. We were extremely supportive to the Ministry of Health in Liberia. The spaces that we have really do depend on a variety of constraints. Here, you know, we have tent structures where people work. Cholera situation again in Afghanistan. The rehabilitations, the tents, all this can't function without a really proper national staff. We feel that the national staff are critical to our presence, and not only the medical staff but also the capacity that we have to be able to employ locals and to employ people's supports, not only through the medical aspect but also through an economic aspect as well. I come now to the tent, the inflatable tents that we used in Pakistan. That's a fairly amazing structure. In Mansera at the time, it was very unfortunate. The Pakistani population there had just inaugurated their new double-storey ward buildings in the Mansera hospital. 1 month later, the earthquake occurred, and the ward buildings were so badly cracked that they had to be condemned and knocked down. So the whole district, the Mansera District Hospital, didn't function. They didn't have a hospital, and we were able to bring in a structure such as that, which inside those inflatable tents, there are two surgical theatres and 120 beds. So it's the reactive capacity that we've got to be able to provide for people very quickly. This took us probably from the start of... from the moment that myself and my colleagues arrived on the ground, it was 2 weeks before we had that up and functioning. In the interim period, we were using different types of tents, but that was... 2 weeks was... We felt were... was as quick as we could get it going. There were hindrances, there were problems that came along, but in the end we provided a very good service under that particular natural disaster. So the space is really critical. And once we are therefore on the ground and in the space, what we then need are the supplies. Really, I mean, the discussion I wanted to give you today was what happens behind the scenes. You can imagine the doctors and the nurses working and providing the medical assistance, but surrounding all that, there's this massive infrastructure which allows for that work to be actually done. Logistics is probably one of our most important aspects. We have become very efficient and very professional at the provision of very good logistical supply. As I said before, the resources that we give our doctors in the field are the latest equipment. Equipment, of course, that is adapted to circumstances. We can't put in fantastically difficult and tricky electronic gear when there's no electricity. So we really make a good assessment of what's the most appropriate technology for the area, and we implement that. The kits here that you can see, those boxes, I think in the middle one you'll see it says reservoir on the left-hand side of one of the boxes. It's right-hand side of one of the boxes. That's a water system. So basically what we provide, along with medical care occasionally, is potable water. And in those kits, in those boxes, you will find a water pump, a series of hoses, a series of bladders that allow us to store the water, chlorination facility and sedimentation facility to make sure we can draw things out of the water or draw the bacteria that clings to the little sort of particles of dust out of the water properly. And that's all in that system. And off the top of my head, I can't tell you how many people that's going to provide, but I think it's probably for about 5,000 cubic litres in these boxes here. So when you're in the field, we can, you know, when we hit a crisis, my experience was that I would be able to make an order, and if I didn't have the computer facilities to be able to send the order, I could simply get on the phone and I could order over the phone and say, I need a kit, a water kit for X number of litres for X number of people in a refugee camp, and it would just simply be boxed up, put in a plane and sent to me, and I can take those boxes and in the field just establish that system immediately. We have kits for many things. We have kits for Land Cruiser vehicles. We have kits for medical situations. One of the classical kits is the 10,000 kit. It's basically the drugs and equipment that we need for to be able to treat 10,000 people in a refugee camp for 3 months. And so we would just ring up and say, we need a 10,000 kit or we need two 10,000 kits, depending on the number of people who are there. And within days or within a week, we can start that that procedure very quickly. We know we have the supplies and we know we're able to provide a good service. That is, I think, that might be a 10,000 kit. It doesn't look so big, you know, at the end of the day. It's a lot of drugs, it's a lot of surgical material, or not so much surgical, bandages, iodine, antibiotics, critical stuff. But as I said, we have kits for kits. We can set up a hospital from a kit. We can set up a we have camp kits for eight people. We have stationary kits for people. Every single aspect of the life that MSF or the situation that you might get into has been broken down into a kit situation whereby it just basically facilitates us to be able to react as quickly as possible. In some circumstances, and this is what happens, the kit is created, it's put together, it's sent, it ends up a week later basically with the pharmacist here dispensing the drugs that the doctor has prescribed, probably in another tent just next door. Pharmacy, I think this is critical for us, and this is the situation. For me, one of the most important things that we actually have, people have always argued what's the most valuable thing that we've got. Personally, I would say humans first. But beside that, then the equipment that we run, it's kits, it's cars, it's water gear. The drugs are incredibly important, and it's critical that we have a very, very good pharmacy management system. It's very dangerous to have expiring drugs. It's very expensive to have expiring drugs, and we are an organisation which relies on private funds. It's not only unethical, we can't give expiring drugs to people, but we also can't let those drugs expire. It's a waste of money, it's a waste of donor resources, which are critical to us. So proper pharmacy management is absolutely important. We do supply a lot of gear ourselves, but we're also very aware that it's not tenable really to just stock everything back in Europe and fly it in. There are very, very many things that we can purchase in local environments. Some of the basic materials, the buckets for the water containers, construction materials, all that sort of thing, we generally source locally. It injects capital into the economy, and it also saves us an awful amount of money in transportation costs as well. There are some things which we necessarily need to buy. We have to buy. Some government legislations will say you need to buy the drugs in this particular location, but if that is the case, then we have very strict assessment policy about the quality of those drugs. We're not sure often that they're of good a quality is necessary, and if we find that's not the case, then we just simply say, look, we are going to have to import those medicines. How am I going for time? Right, okay, so I'm sorry, I could go on really at length. I've been told I've got about 5 minutes left because I think people would like to have questions. So there are some really important things to mention. The supplies we've talked about. Behind the scenes, then, really, it's about the people that we're looking at. 8% of the population, 8% of our staff come from international. We have 19 sections working around the world who supply people. They're Australian, Canadians, Americans, Japanese, Norwegians, Danes, Italians, French, and that's just the international, what we call the international group. The national group draws from all the societies of the countries that we work in. We recruit physicians. We are Médecins Sans Frontières. We are Doctors Without Borders. It's important. It's the medical act that we're doing, that we're facilitating. So the doctors are critical. Paramedical staff are critical, and non-medical staff for the infrastructure around that is really what is necessary to be provided. There is no seniority in profession. You will find nurses who manage doctors. You will find doctors who manage large evaluation teams. You will find paramedical or non-medicals who will manage the whole country. It's down to what the situation requires at the time. I am non-medical, but I have been gloved up and covered in iodine and cleaning wounds in conflict situations because we just simply didn't have enough people to be able to support. You pitch in where you can. People need to be very, very flexible. We put people in some pretty difficult situations at times, but at the end of the day, for me, I warn and encourage people at the same time, doing this work will change you. It changes you in a little way or a very large way. Your capacity, your thoughts about the world, your thoughts about humanity But I've never, in 12 years of working for MSF, had anyone who's ever said to me, gosh, even when it's really difficult, even when it's terrible in the field, even when you're perhaps terribly clashing with your team members, or clashing even with the organisation, we have situations whereby there have been, you know, formal concerns and complaints. We are a slice of humanity. We are not saints. We are not ideologues. Some of us are ideologues. We are not saints. We are humans, and that we come with flaws as well. So, you know, we don't always get things correct. That's really important. And so there are conflicts, and there are issues that occur within the organisation. There is endless criticism and endless debate. No one has ever said to me, I wish I hadn't done that. No one has ever regretted being a part of the organisation. It's a very powerful tool. Some of us, I think the American phrase is, swim deeply in the Kool-Aid. But as I pointed out the charter before about ethical, independent, engaged, impartial medical action, it's also not a bad way of living one's life as well. The essence of MSF is really about the medical act between the doctor and the patient, but surrounding all that comes all these people who have dedicated themselves to it for a very long time. A few slides, negotiation with people, our contact with and our proximity to the local populations is paramount. We are an organisation who does send or ask or offer, I guess, we don't force people to do this, we offer them the facility, the possibility to really get very close to what the population is experiencing. There are many times when I and my team have been the only expatriates in an area for thousands of kilometres. We are very, very concerned about security. It is one of the most difficult situations in the world today in terms of conflict. It is paramount. We have very strict security rules, and that involves a great deal of communication with all sides of a conflict. People would say we have shaken hands with the devil. There are devils in many guises, and to make sure that we continue to have access to a civilian population, our negotiation capacity and our capacity to be able to develop that humanitarian space within a society, and to ensure free access and quality access of healthcare to the population is critical. I think at that point I'm going to stop. I think I am running out of time, and I think people would like some questions. So thank you very much for listening to me. I'm sorry if I've spoken too quickly. I know I have a tendency to do that. There's an awful lot of information to get in there. So thank you very much for the time.
You've been listening to Nick Lawson, Director of Field Human Resources at Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. Recorded on March 13th in Anchorage, he spoke on managing an emergency behind the scenes at Doctors Without Borders. You can view the photographs he presented to the Alaska World Affairs Council on our website, kska.org. Following his presentation, Mr. Lawson responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, with all of your focus on emergencies, do you have any opportunity to do preventative medicine like immunizations or family planning? Secondly, have you had any problems with female staff working in countries that may not appreciate women as much as we do in Western societies?
Yep. I'll answer the first question first. In terms of preventative care, family planning we provide that service through our primary health care. It's been a push over the last couple of years to make sure that women's health and mother and child health care is absolutely an integral part of every program, and that it's not just a vertical program in itself, that it is put in place as part of a hospital service or a primary health care service that we provide. So those facilities are available. We are searching ever increasingly for obstetricians and gynecologists to be able to provide safe birthing technique and to provide good quality cesarean section. The maternal mortality in a lot of the countries you work in is at a horrific rate, and what we can try and do to ameliorate that is we'll do everything that we can, but to make sure that it's at like an integral part of our package of services is the first step, and we are certainly engaged very strongly in that. In terms of vaccinations, in terms of primary health care, there are things, EPI, expanded programs of immunisation that UNICEF and WHO support quite strongly. We facilitate those if they're part of our, if we're running a primary health care service in a certain location, but it's not an actual driving activity that we do. We will provide it if we are in conjunction or working in conjunction with the UN at that point. But certainly in terms of preventative health care, Under emergency circumstances, I discussed before, the meningitis and the measles, absolutely, we're in that. As for women, welcome is all I can say. And in Islamic societies, even more so. It's been very tough for me in Afghanistan. The media and the reporting on Afghanistan was very hard, and it was pretty black and white, and it was pretty limited in their knowledge. When we were in Afghanistan, and this was during the time of the Taliban, and I was working very closely with Taliban as they controlled certainly areas that we were functioning in, we were able to employ Afghan female staff. We were able to employ them as doctors, as nurses, as registrators, and that sort of thing. The Taliban themselves simply wanted to have a separation in the clinic. They wanted to have a wall between the men and the women, so the men didn't gaze on the women all the time. And to ensure that, we said, look, well, we've got to employ Afghan women staff. That's just, there's no other way. And they said, okay, well, yes, you've got to do that. For the expatriate staff, there were a couple of difficult situations that prevented us, that we sort of said, right, we shouldn't have women staff. And then we sort of lasted about 4 months before we realised that we weren't getting the access to the population as we should have access to it. And then to do that, we said, okay, we have to revisit that policy. And we started recruiting expatriate staff again. And expatriate women staff in these societies, I have found, my own experience over a fairly long time, is that they have, I loathe to use this term, but honorary male status in the society. It's not a great way of describing it, but I can't at this moment think of another way. They themselves have access to the same things that the men have access to, because they are expatriate, because they are guests in a country. There are some moments when the Taliban are not going to shake the woman's hand, and you know, we just have to deal with that. Women have to wear a headscarf in certain locations. At the end of the day, we have more important things, personally, I feel, to in the battle of providing medical care and ensuring women's health than to fight over whether or not wearing a headscarf is the right thing to be doing or not. But having the women, female staff, expat staff there, gives them access to the male population and access to the female population. So they see the whole side of things, and providing the good quality of care, that the optimum care will come from doing that. And we really haven't had any problems with that at all.
In his talk, Mr. Lawson mentioned that Doctors Without Borders helps people on both sides of a conflict in a given country. How does that play out in your hospitals? An audience member wanted to know. How do you deal with people on different sides of a conflict under one roof?
I guess primarily when I say we deal on both sides of the conflict, we're really targeting the civilian population on both sides of that conflict. But as I said before, I still remember a very clear Sunday in Sudan, and getting a call from our staff at the hospital saying there are 40 wounded soldiers who are arriving, and you know, we're going to need some help. We disarm a population. Well, it depends. Often in the conflicts, there's such a frontline situation that the combatants themselves don't cross over. But on either side, we will take then those people, or those people who are wounded and injured, into our care as any other human being. We have a very strict no weapons policy. We have a very strict, and if people need to be watched or people need to be guarded, then we will do that. But it will be without weapons and without arms. We haven't really had issues whereby, you know, one side of the conflict and the other side of the conflict are in sort of beds set next to each other, sort of punching each other. But it's really about one of the beautiful things that I've learned over the last few years is medicine is a great, how should I put it? It's a great leveler of society. Everyone wants to be well, and everyone actually understands the need for that at some point. I mean, people, it's very difficult. I might be naive in saying this, but I think it's very, very difficult to corrupt in ways that, or in other ways that perhaps other assistants might be more easy. But everyone understands the nature of medicine, and everyone understands the nature of sick people. We don't really see very much where the combatants are side by side, but certainly the importance for us is to make sure that the structures that we have are humanitarian spaces, and that they are free of weapons and free of conflict.
Soon another hand rose within the audience asking, has Doctors Without Borders been expelled from all of Sudan? There is currently a group of Alaskan volunteers in southern Sudan. What is your feeling on their safety in that part of the country?
Southern Sudan has not been affected by this current recent activity. for Doctors Without Borders in northern Sudan and specifically Darfur. The French section and the Dutch section have been expelled. The Belgian, Swiss and Spanish sections are still active. They're in Khartoum at the moment. There has been a security incident, which means that we have withdrawn back to Khartoum, but they haven't been expelled. Our programs, however, in southern Sudan, which are run out of Juba, are still functioning, and it's a tense situation. There's no doubt. Nobody really knows whether it can spill that way. The political moves, of course, are towards the referendum. I think it's in 2010 or 11, I believe, in southern Sudan, about the potential for independence. That's a future trigger of violence I would be worried about, and we must consider. But at this point in time in southern Sudan, we're still there.
There have been reports that three people from Doctors Without Borders have been picked up in Sudan, another audience member stated. Can you confirm this report? If so, do you know who took them and where?
We're not sure by whom either. There is a militia group, which has been... Three of our people have been kidnapped. They've had the opportunity to make a phone call, and they say they are being well treated. We've had one contact from them on Wednesday night. We currently at the moment are in very, very strong negotiations to make sure they're safe release. It's a difficult situation, and of course it impacts upon our work. It forces the return of people out of the field, and then the population, and that's what I speak about in terms of a diminishing humanitarian space that occurs. That sort of assault upon the ideals of humanitarian principle is just unacceptable. We are not there for anything other than providing healthcare for a civilian population, and we have been targeted for whatever reason we've been targeted, and we find that to be unacceptable. So we are in very heavy negotiation at this point in time.
Next, someone from the audience asked, how much time do you find your staff spends teaching local people skills that they can carry on after you have left?
Oh, it's critical. I think one of the most... The thing that frustrates a lot of first mission people when they start with MSF is that they sort of think they're going to be the doctor treating the patient. Oftentimes they're the trainer of the clinical officers who are teaching the patient. And so they have to find a balance and find time to treat themselves, or treat the patients themselves. A lot of the time, we expect all of the doctors who go in either formally or informally hold seminars about pathology and treatment. We ourselves bring new protocols. We are constantly revising the protocols, and so that transfer of knowledge is critical. And that does happen across all of the disciplines, from medical to paramedical to non-medical. I've very many times as a logistician sitting down and training people the proper use of chlorine to provide drinking water out of kind of muddy water holes and things. We have endless logistical training. There are medical technical weeks that we train people on in terms of HIV, in terms HIV, nutrition, vaccination, surgical programs whereby we send surgeons in on a regular basis to work with locals to provide better facilities. Always, as I said before, thinking about the correct or the appropriate technology that we're using at a particular time. But training is critical to us. We're not a development organisation. We wouldn't go so far ever to say that. We really are an emergency organisation. But the idea is that we're going to leave. We've got to leave something, and that's critical, to leave that education behind.
Another doctor in the audience who once cared for combatants in Somalia asked Mr. Lawson, while remaining neutral in war zones, are you ever conflicted in deciding who is entitled to medical care? Secondly, he asked, as Doctors Without Borders seems to be engaging in more non-emergency situations such as the spread of HIV and family planning, are you taking over the job of the government?
I mean, to answer your first question about the combatants in Somalia, yeah, it's tough. How do you determine who has the right to care? And I agree, there have been many debates about who we should and we shouldn't be treating. A lot of it is down to emergency triage. Who is the most sick? Who is the most in need of care at a particular time? If you use that as a fundamental principle of access, then you know you're saving the ones who are going to die, and it's very difficult for us to call judgment on humans when we're just trying to provide medical care. It's a wrestle, and I won't pretend to have a proper and clear cut solution. And I know a lot of our teams are probably conflicted with the same sort of thing. what to do. Do we expand our program to provide that facility for the militia? We don't certainly aim to do that, but we provide a hospital, and if there's an ongoing violence situation, then yes, you know, we're going to treat those people who are wounded. I agree, it is tough. And as much as we try and target the civilian population first and foremost, we are going to see combatants come through. For the second question, it's a good point, shifting to the long-term projects. But I could also argue that HIV, we would categorise as an emergency. The number of people that we know carry HIV in sub-Saharan Africa is just what we're treating, even though we're treating a huge number of people, there's still many, many more that go untreated. And the longer-term project, I know for us, as I was the head of mission in Malawi, it's not a conflict situation. It's not a difficult country to actually work in as such. The population is not dying on the doorstep, you know, with terrible trauma, but they really are going through a dire situation in terms of that. And our response is not to go long-term development slow. Our response is to try to shovel ARVs into as many people as we possibly can to at least keep them alive, because there are people dying at the moment. Every time that we take a step towards research or a step towards something else, it's a slowing down of that process and more people are going to die. So there is that issue. In terms of longer-term projects, really, I guess, you know, that's... We're constantly reviewing our parameters of intervention. And we really try to stick very hard to conflict, post-conflict. Some of the longer-term stuff does exist, and it is the HIV and the TB that we're really looking at. But I would argue strongly, and this is, I guess, my personal opinion within the organisation, is that we're not equipped to start dealing with the creation of public healthcare systems. And although it seems at times that we take on a role where the government does abdicate or appears to abdicate their responsibility, they are also times that we can choose to withdraw. When I was in Burundi for a year, 2004 to 2005, we made a decision at that point that, okay, the conflict is over, we're going to leave, and we're not likely to leave a better situation, in fact. We're not. But the objective to serve the population under conflict had been met, and at that point we were then looking at other organisations who were potentially better experienced, more experienced or better qualified, or had as their objective or goals to provide a more development service to the population. And so we were fortunate enough to be able to find an organisation and make a healthy handover. There is always a frustration within the teams about the government abdicating their responsibility and putting money towards military or putting money towards different things. And we have to take each case as it comes.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Nick Lawson, Director of Field Human Resources at Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk on managing an emergency behind the scenes at Doctors Without Borders, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on Friday, March 13th, 2009. You can view the photographs he presented to the Alaska World Affairs Council on our website, KSKA.org. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit KSKA.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at KSKA.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.